Well, and you go on to talk a little bit about here about a book by a guy named Mark Lee Raphael, talking about the Jews being involved in the world slave trade back in the 15th and 16th centuries. And there was always a clear link between the Muranos, who had left Spain earlier for the New World and set up shop in all of the Latin American countries as well as the southern part of the United States. But what happened was they used their agents within the Arab community to go down into sub-Saharan Africa and herd up millions of unsuspecting and unprepared Africans to be shipped out of the, I guess it's the West African nation of Senegal and the Ivory Coast, and be shipped over as slaves. And they were knee deep in this whole conspiracy, making money hand over fist on human trafficking, not different than what they're doing today out of the Balkans, not different than what they've done throughout history. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, well, I mean, what you find, there's what we'll focus on in a future show, because I think this is when we go back as far as 1930. There was someone called Elizabeth Donnan who published a book, six volume set on the slave trade, and you can actually trace the slave ships. If you go into Yahoo and type in Jewish owned slave ships, it comes up with the names and the people that owned them, and they're all Jewish names. What this guy Mark Lee Raphael said in this book here, he said Jewish merchants played a major role in the slave trade. In fact, Jewish merchants frequently dominated. Well, it's not frequently, because certainly all the ships that I've seen with the owners have never had a non-Jewish owner. So it's a, they did dominate, they were in control, and then they used the attitude now to try and promote, obviously whites did buy slaves in America, that's not something that I'm denying, but what I'm getting at is that they'll never say that Jewish merchants were involved. It was all nasty white people enslaving blacks, when it was actually the Jews that were making the money off that.
And it hasn't stopped, is my point. I'd like everyone to know that that they were also implicated in a female slaves coming out of the Balkans and Moravia and Bosnia Herzegovina and Croatia during that and Serbia during the conflict there, and have continued to come out of places like Romania and Bulgaria and Kurdistan and the Georgian region till this day. And there are young women being traded and sold off into prostitution and domestic slavery and all kinds of stuff, all the way up until the present, ladies and gentlemen. I want to go on to a guy named Jack Bernstein, who I put his book on my website. It's been there for some time. Jack was actually murdered for this, a book that he wrote about his experience in Israel. You want to talk a little bit about what you found when you looked at Jack Bernstein's history?
Well, it's interesting, Darryl, because as we mentioned Ostrovsky earlier, now Jack Bernstein was of course murdered, and in his I won't read the whole foreword, people can read it on the site, the statement, but he does say basically in his statement that what Zionists do to people who disagree with them is they'll first attack them and then try and discredit their character. They'll never ever try and prove the information wrong, and then their last resort is to kill them. And of course, they killed Jack Bernstein. Now, with Viktor Ostrovsky, again, the same thing. They didn't attack any of his information, but as we discussed on a previous show, one of their agents did go on the Canadian television and ask if a loyal Jew in Canada would kill him for them.
Yes, a Sam, they call them, I think. Yep.
Yeah. And exactly. And again, so these people, I mean, Mordecai Vanunu, where are they being attacked for what they're saying? They're never being attacked for what they're saying. They're never being proved wrong. They're just being attacked for, they're trying to get them on the personality. They're trying to threaten them. They never come out and can say this information is wrong.
Well, I've had the same thing happen to me here from where I sit, Andrew, and you've seen it happen.
Oh, absolutely. As you know, I've heard every one of your shows, so I see all the different things that have happened, and I get the same on certain sites. I think another review popped up. I haven't read it myself. Another negative review on Amazon trying to bring the book down. But they do it for the simple reason. They never attack any facts on there. They just say, oh, this is dangerous, this book. Oh, it says this, it says that. Well, what bit's dangerous? Tell me. What bit do you disagree with? Tell me what the truth is. Because, you know, if I'm wrong, I'd like to know. But they don't want to tell you that because they know that you're right and they're just there to try and frighten people away from you, using the anti-Semitic tag as usual, rather than, you know, useful historical review of events. They won't negotiate with you or review you on that. They'll just try to attack you on other things. And it's just so sad that people believe that rather than looking at the facts for themselves and coming up to their own conclusions.
Well, what's happening, and you may have some experience with this, but I have. I've been getting written, people sending me emails from the Jewish community, actually shocked at some of my work, and others' emails coming in saying that they actually believe and agree with. Now, a lot of people don't know this, but not every Jew in the world is a Zionist, and certainly, when pushed to a wall and attacked from all corners, Jews may, in spite of their differences, stick together, and that in itself may be a problem. But the fact is, there are huge groups of Jewish people out there that have been for decades and even longer fighting Zionism. Zionism just has deep pockets and very powerful apparatus and apparatchik to go out and stop any resistance in its own community. But you know, you can cite places, things like Natura Carta. Now, I don't agree with anybody who follows Talmudic tradition, and if Natura Carta is one of them, then they have run afoul of my feelings. But at the same time, they do not believe, and have stated so, that Israel should ever have come into being, and that the true and greatest crime of our lifetimes is what has happened to Palestine and the Palestinians since Israel's founding. So, but I don't want to go too much further into that, except to tell you all, Jack Bernstein went over there and found out exactly what it was like to be a Jew who was in disfavor. And it was because his marriage to a Sephardi that he went under the he became pressured by the Ashkenazi, who are about 85, almost 90% of the Israeli population. So we'll move on from there and talk about this guy Pollard. Now, you probably do, throughout this book, have come across dozens of events of espionage that Israel has committed against America. But I want to speak to the idea that the number one country in the world that spies on the United States has always been Israel and continues to be to this day. But you want to talk a little bit about the Pollard case?
Yes, well, as you say, Dale, there's so many incidents of that we've already talked about, of Israel spying on America, and people like Richard Perle and these others involved, all the usual suspects.
This guy Sandy Berger under Clinton was stealing documents out of the White House and out of the Defense Department and giving them to Israel as well?
Yeah, mega looks like that Michael Moore's agent's brother, that Rahm Emanuel, doesn't it? That
yep.
Points to possibly that. There's all sorts of... there's so many... this is one of the earlier ones, although we have got them going right back to the 60s with the 50s, 60s with the case there. But here, Pollard was arrested, I believe we're at 85 now, for passing classified information to the Israeli Defense Ministry's Scientific Liaison Bureau, which incidentally was run by Rafael Eitan, who took part in the 1960 abduction of Adolf Eichmann from Argentina. Pollard worked in research at the Naval Investigative Service, based just outside Washington. Excuse me. And he was transferred to the Anti-Terrorism Alert Center.
Why, you want to get a glass of there, or a drink of water there, Andrew?
Yeah, sorry, I've had a bit of...
Go ahead and do that.
I thought it was going. Hold on one moment.
Ladies and gentlemen, you know, this stuff is all verifiable. Everything we talk about here has been... researched, and if you look into any one of these claims we make, and just begin to poke around on the net or even in any library in your area, you're going to start finding that the things we are discussing in this book are spot on, and they're historic. So you really need to pay heed to these facts, because they're irrefutable in almost every instance I've come across here. Go ahead, Andrew. I think you're probably
No, I apologize to you and the listeners. Basically,
don't worry.
I sort of flew for about 3 days. I had my worst day yesterday, but it was getting better today. I just had a little attack then. But yeah, as I say, so the Pollard case is just one of many, and we'll talk about another earlier case, late 50s, which actually resulted in some executions then for agents working in the U.S. government that were passing cases, passing secrets to Israel. Their names escape me now, but that's certainly one of the early events of it.
Well, let's move on. We're going to pass the Klinghoffer thing on the Achille Lauro, because that's pretty cut and dry here. But I want to go on to the N.M. Rothschild and Sons takeover of British Gas, because we see gas in France has just been taken over by Suez Lyonnais des Eaux, and that is also a I think Rothschild is the principal, and there are other Zionists involved in the ownership of Suez. But you want to talk a little bit about that, because it moves right into today's water company takeovers like you've discussed.
Yes, well, the interesting thing here, I mean, what happened was Rothschild was brought in as to advise the British government on the privatization of British Gas, and they subsequently advised all these other privatizations, British Steel, British Coal, the British Electricity, again, the water system. Now, the interesting thing here is... back in the 80s, it was like we had all the boom time coming in, the sort of, you know, 85, 86, all this sort of, you know, 87, all this great type of, we're all going ahead here, and there was all these yuppies, and everyone had money. And what they were doing was, with these privatizations, they'd set a figure. And so, you know, anybody in the population could apply for a certain amount of shares, and, you know, then you would generally get them, and you could buy those shares. And what would happen is, after you bought them, they would literally rise, in some cases, by 30% the next day, because they were setting the price quite low for the government. So they were setting it too low, and of course big corporations could buy an amount as well. But that isn't where they got them. The key is and what I believe happened, is they were working up doing all these privatizations of state-owned assets, for the simple reason that they knew they were going to pull the plug in the 90s, crash the stock market, and do exactly the same as what Nathan Rothschild did back in 1812 with his Battle of Waterloo, pretending that Napoleon had won, so everyone was running around selling things for, you know, 5 cents on the dollar or 5p on the pound, whatever you want to call it. And then he was gathering them all up. And so I think the idea here was to, they knew what they wanted, they've known what they want, they want control of country's assets and what have you. So let's get the government to sell them all off. We'll let them go up a little bit, so people start buying them, pushing the price up. Then we'll pull the plug, and then we'll come in and get all these people who are bailing out, and then really assert our control that way.
Well, that happened. That same formula has been employed about 10 years after Britain here in France during the mid-90s, and even up until today for state assets of France, which have been sold at fire sale. You'll see a company called Alstom, who had a huge stake owned by the government, Thomson Electronics also, many of them, even the phone company. The initial rise was very good for people, and then these things tanked terribly. Everybody dumped their shares, and then they were scooped up at wholesale at very low prices by a single group, and now they're in the hands of a very small number of elite criminal Zionists. And it's a formula that has worked for them country after country, and they keep employing it, don't they, Andrew?
Well, yes. I mean, again, if there was a situation where suddenly British Gas is up for sale and the shares are up for sale and Rothschild just buy it all off the government, they've got control, then that's too overt, you see. So they have to do it covertly. They have to try and make out that it's always for the benefit of everyone. We can all own a bit of our country and a bit of our assets and what have you. And so they'll do it that way instead. They'll grab a nice chunk of it initially with the facilities that corporations have got the ability to bid for a certain percentage, etc., etc. And they'll use different corporations to do that. They'll all link under the same umbrella that they always do. And then they'll get the rest by manipulating the stock market. And that's the way that they do it. They can't do it straight away, overtly, but they know what they want and they know they're going to get it when they want it.
Well, I'll give everybody an example of how they took over Alstom. It went down as low as 40 cents a share. Mm. That stock is now sitting at 30 euros.
Yeah.
And when they brought it to 40 cents, there were rumors everywhere that it was going bankrupt. Nobody would want those shares for anything, and they just flooded the market with the personal shares. Even the workers got rid of their shares in their pension funds. And all were bought up, and now the company is getting massive numbers of contracts, and most of all the shares are held in a very small group of hands, like Lagardère and Bouygues and others that are actual agents of Rothschild. But you want to talk to here about Mr. Vanunu here, because he has really been a pain in the neck to these folks and these criminals. And you talk a little bit about how they cannot have a single Jew come out and speak out against them who has any real information. They will go to any lengths to make sure that person doesn't speak. And what did they do to Mr. Vanunu?
Well, Mr. Vanunu had come out and he'd actually gone to a British paper to with facts and also, interestingly, photos about the Israel's nuclear weapons program. Now, Vanunu was a technician at Dimona, which is Israel's nuclear installation. So he was in there, he could see the nuclear weapons, he could take the photos, he could write about them, he was a technical guy, so he knew about them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, he's gone to a British newspaper, thinking it's a British newspaper, whereas, of course, as we know, all the media is controlled by Zionists. So they've scuttled back and warned their friends in Israel. And suddenly, he's been essentially seduced, if you like, by an Israeli Mossad agent called Shel Bentov, who was operating under the name of Cindy. And she persuaded Mordechai Vanunu because he'd gone to London, and she persuaded him to fly to Rome with her on holiday. And once he was in Rome, the Mossad actually kidnapped him, drugged him, drove him to a deserted beach, and smuggled him to Israel. Again, completely bypassing any sort of extradition proceedings or anything like that. They don't like to obey any country's laws. They like to go in there completely unlawfully, get someone. What they did then, they had a secret trial. They imprisoned him for 18 years for treason and espionage, which is something Israel very good at. And interestingly, he's not actually spied for any foreign power, and he received no payment for his exposure, so there wasn't espionage there at all. Throughout the trial and subsequently, the Israeli government have refused to admit or deny whether or not they have any nuclear weapons.
Mm. And you can bring that news all the way up to today with the statement that the only nuclear armed nation in the Middle East is Israel. And the fact is that Iran has no ability to produce a bomb by expert analysis for some 5 to 7 years from now. In other words, they don't have a bomb now, nor do they have one in the immediate future. The only bomb-carrying nation is this racist, xenophobic, murderous, terrorist-sponsoring criminal group of nut jobs called Israel.
Well, I totally agree with you, Daryl.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, isn't it, how the only people that have a bomb in that area are Israel. They deny having it, they certainly won't confirm to having it. The only reason that they've got it is they got it through espionage that we've talked about already, and I don't think there's any show that we can do as we go through this book, certainly in the 20th century, that doesn't have Israeli espionage in it. The other situation, of course, if they've got nuclear weapons and the sort of danger that they present, why should other Middle Eastern countries not have weapons to protect themselves? Because these people are insane. You know, we should be providing them with the weapons to prevent Israel from causing you know, World War III. But instead we're allowing them to operate in whichever way that they choose, never criticising them. And it's just so sad to watch.
Well, you talk a little bit here about the late 80s being a time of great theft here with the Ivan Boesky, Jewish, Dennis Levine, Jewish, Martin Siegel, Jewish, Michael Milken, Jewish, all of these people, huge thieving criminals. And you point out clearly, and you know, I believe this guy Oliver Stone is also Jewish, but he did a film about Gordon Gekko and you know how greed is good. It's kind of glossing over the sinisterness of the criminal theft that was going on in the 80s, and what we've got today and has eclipsed the 1980s theft by tenfold. With the Enron and the WorldCom and, I mean, and so forth, all Zionist Jewish motivated and controlled conspiracies themselves. But it's incredible, Andrew, that we don't balk at the sight of these people's names any longer, because the way that they're discussed in the press never makes them villainous. You see, Boesky even and Michael Milken were actually almost characterized as legendary figures rather than the evil thieving criminals that they were, and so I mean it's stomach turning to think that you know a small time crook who steals something from a corner store would get a more severe sentence than somebody who is stealing billions. And then almost 9 out of 10 times those thefts are done by this group.
Well, definitely. And the other thing is mentioned here, Oliver Stone is Jewish. He pretends that he's French, but he is Jewish.
Cool.
Oliver Stone.
Yes.
And the interesting thing here, we've mentioned on another, I think the very first show I ever did with you, about the JFK film. Now, of course,
yes.
Oliver Stone did the JFK film. What
yep.
did he talk about in JFK? Nothing about Zionism, nothing about Kennedy wanting to print United States notes. Nothing about Kennedy threatening, you know, telling Israel that they're not to have nuclear weapons. Nothing about that's in the film. It's just a fog of different could be this, could be that, probably CIA with the mafia, with the Cubans. He just stirs up a fog that no one can see through. And that's what Oliver Stone's job for me is. He's one of their favourite directors, to take something like that and just divert the attention away. The Gordon Gekko character is referred to as essentially an American kid, grew up, got lucky on the stock market and became like some billionaire.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the silencing of free speech and free thought here with the Public Order Act in Britain in 1986, and motivated and written by Jewish interests for Jewish interests. And it basically was taking away Magna Carta rights and rights for assembly to discuss things, free thought, and the rest of it. We were really starting to see the beginnings of the whole concept of thought criminals in this period, were we not?
Well, yes, and I've said about this on a few occasions, that the idea is to bring in something like the Public Order Act to say, well, we've got to protect the rights of minorities and things like that, and they'll never actually say Jewish. They'll say about black immigrants or homosexuals or whatever, and we don't want these nasty skinheads or whatever going and doing this, that, and the other. But it's all about dictating what people can and can't say. And of course, again, through the back door, gets in through the back door is if, for example, you were to sort of say something, you know, go out on the street and say something about, look, there's Jewish power or Zionist power, they'll say, oh, that's part of this act, you see, because we're getting upset now because you're pointing that out. Well, you're pointing out fact, but fact isn't good enough anymore, because if they feel threatened by that, even though you're pointing out fact and you're saying names of different people, you're showing the pattern of these same people controlling things. And the interesting thing here is the act was placed before Parliament by the Home Secretary, Leon Britton, whose real name is Leon Britton-Iski, and he's a Lithuanian Jew. and his cousin, another Lithuanian Jew, and you were never told they were cousins when they were in Parliament, by the way, Malcolm Rifkin, who was known as Malcolm Rifkind, that was his name in the cabinet, who went on to be Foreign Secretary. So we've got the third highest and the second highest job under the Chancellor, and then you've got the Prime Minister. So we've got, what, three and four in the British government there, getting together and getting this through.
It doesn't change as far as, you know, it just continues on and on. And many of these things have the same MO. And the one I think you just pointed out, and I'd like everybody to mark as an important element here, is the crypto nature of their people in power. And over here in France, when Sarkozy was running for president, he claimed to be a Catholic. Now, this is a guy who was on a youth tour of Israel in 1967 during the war. This is a guy whose grandfather was one of the most preeminent and prominent rabbi leaders in Salonika, Greece, during the Turkish implosion of the Ottoman Empire. And the fact is this man has always known exactly what his roots were. And right now he's traipsing around the world with a woman named Carla Bruni, who is also Jewish. And she is a crypto and doesn't ever talk about the fact that she is Jewish. The simple truth of the matter is in most instances, these people keep that hidden from people because they do not want the appearance that all Jews are involved in all of these actions. But in fact, once you dig a little bit below the surface, you find out that everybody in power in all the principal countries of the West are Jews. And this is a painful fact that everybody needs to really understand, because in spite of a man having a name Britain, his name isn't Britain. And in spite of a man named possibly George Bush, who knows what his roots are? People have alluded to the fact that he goes back to Solomon Bush, a Jew that came into the country back in the 1720s and 30s. We're still digging up the truth about all of these people, but we know the characteristics of Muranos is to claim Christianity and then be Jewish. This is a thread that runs through all of the countries that we discuss, is it not, Andrew?
Oh, it is, yes. And this is where we ask the listeners to do digging for themselves and help us, because we can only look into so much as we can look into. And it's important to find as much information out as we can, because we're going to defeat these people by getting the information out.
Well, we've talked about Wesley Clark changing his name and Madeleine Albright and a guy named Dean from New Hampshire and all of them Jewish. And the fact is, John Kerry, whose name was Khan, who changed it to Kerry because it sounded like a nice Irish Bostonian name. And these incidences are not isolated. In fact, they're as much the rule as anything about this conspiracy, and people need to really understand it. Let's go on here and talk about the World Bank and the Bank of International Settlements, and because I think this is important to start talking about because of the events that are overtaking our world right now financially. You talk about the three arms. It says here the World Bank and the Bank of International Settlement and the International Monetary Fund. Talk a little bit about the things that were going on with these people in the late 80s, early 90s.
Well, what they did was they, through their Bank of International Settlements arm, they basically required the world's bankers to raise their capital and reserves to 8% of their liabilities by 1992, which put an upper limit on fractional reserve lending. Now, what happened, for an example here in Japan, they had the lowest capital, one of the lowest capitals in reserve, and so as a result of this requirement, and of course, they're making a requirement of a sovereign state here. Japan is a sovereign state, but because they say jump, so this is important now, because this is a bank telling a sovereign state what to do. Now, in order for this sovereign state, Japan, to do this, the value of its stock market would crash by 50%, and commercial real estate crashed by 60% within 2 years. The idea was for the IMF to create more and more of their international currency known as special drawing rights, or rather SDRs, which are backed by nothing, in order for struggling nations to borrow them and therefore increase their cash reserves to the required Bank of International Settlements level, because of course if they didn't have the cash to the 8%, they had to borrow that to get the 8%. And so of course, who could they borrow from? Ooh, the International Monetary Fund. And so, of course, by borrowing from them to get up to the 8%, that gives these people leverage that they can then charge interest, and they can then say, oh, we want you all the system, we want this, we want the other, as and when they could not pay interest on the debt.
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is that this financial group right now, if you want to sign on to what Mohammed Rafik has to say about this, is that this actually is happening a little quicker than they had planned. I don't know that to be true or not true. All I do know is that the mega inflating or the hyperinflating of our economies is causing prices to go absolutely off the hook crazy. Here in France, we're reaching record prices for almost everything you have to buy in a store. At the same time, we have a shrinking of the labor market, and we have problems coming from every quarter. And in the long run, and in the final analysis, the only group that's going to be left standing after the dust settles is the people that orchestrated these crimes, and it's going to be that group of three, people behind the IMF, people behind the World Bank and the Bank of International Settlement, and their agents, such as Goldman Sachs, N.M. Rothschild and Lazard Frere and the Oppenheimer Group and so forth.